One cold and bitter Thursday in Munich, Germany, eight great football stalwarts conceded victory. Eight men will never play again who met destruction there. The flowers of English football, the flowers of Manchester.
Hello, you're listening to Barclay and Barton on a post-war history of Manchester United. Me, Matt Beadle, here with retired but renowned sports journalist Paddy Barclay. Hello, Paddy.
Hi, good evening.
Great to have you on the show. Also joining us, as ever, is the great, the author, the historian, Wayne Barton.
The great. Good evening, Matt. How are you doing?
Very good. Thank you. You've got to say great. You've done some sterling things in your time, yeah. Wayne Barton.
Absolutely.
This is episode 9 in our series of trawling through the archives with Manchester United. Like we said, a post-war history of the Red Devils. This particular episode, Munich.
The third time down the runway, disaster followed close. There was slush upon that runway, and the aircraft never rose.
This is Love Sport.
Okay, gentlemen, we touched on this in our first show, in fact, when we were looking at the partnership between Busby and Murphy, but clearly it deserved an entire show on itself. It was February the 6th, 1958. Wayne, United were on their way back from what was then known as Yugoslavia, of course, having secured their passage into the European Cup semi-finals for the second time running. They'd beaten Red Star Belgrade 5-4 on aggregate. The plane stopped to refuel in Munich, and then tragically, disaster struck. We'll move on to the fallout of the tragedy in a moment, but first, Wayne, let's just set the scene and reflect on the magnitude of how good this side were at the time.
Yeah, as we discussed in the earlier show about Sir Matt and Jimmy, you know, Sir Matt had assembled this side that was described as the greatest in the world, and I always stress that point when people are asking. They debate the lost potential and everything like that. This was a side who were already achieving. They were described as the best. They'd been eliminated from the European Cup in 1957 in a classic tie against Real Madrid. And if one wants a modern comparison, really, you can liken it to what I would describe as a coming-of-age trilogy, dramedy of Manchester United versus Juventus in the 90s, where you had the education of the first games, where they were getting schooled a bit by the dominant continental side. Mm-hmm. Then the suggestion that they were going to come good and take them on and conquer them. And then, obviously, the third one being in 99, where United did overcome them and were the better side on that occasion. And you could probably use that comparison to assess where the Busby Babes were at the time. They seemed destined for their paths to collide with Real Madrid, whether it would be in the semi-final, quarter-final, final, no matter what. It was going to be a case of them colliding together. But as it turned out, Paddy, destiny had different ideas.
Yeah, well, which takes us to February 1958. As you say, the background is that this Manchester United team was really... It was probably the second, 57-8 would have been the second season in a row that they were... I mean, people talk about the treble of 1999, but this was back in, 57 and 58. They seemed to be going for the treble every year. I mean, that's how good they were. To give you another measure, one of the players who died at Munich was Jeff Bent. Jeff would maybe play 3 games a season, something like that. And yet, he was so good that Wolves, who were one of the other top sides of that time, wanted to buy him. And Matt Busby wouldn't let him go. I mean, that was how good he was. It would be, I don't know, say if it's this season, it would be like Manchester City trying to get James Milner back from Liverpool or something like that. It was just Jeff Bent was really fantastic, one of the best players in England in his position. There were Manchester United's reserve team could probably have played in the equivalent of the Premier League in those days. I mean, that was how the magnitude of what Matt Busby had built. They were, however, not the most... Game management was probably the chink in their armour, because they basically just tried to outscore the opposition all the time. In the final two league matches before they went to Munich, they scored 12 goals. They won 5-4. They beat Bolton 7-2 at Old Trafford in a match with a performance that was hailed as perfection, despite the concession of two goals. They then went to the final match before going to Belgrade via Munich. Was down at Arsenal, and it's widely held to have been one of the best games that Manchester United ever played. It ended with the entire crowd, obviously mainly made up of Arsenal fans, 60,000, giving a standing ovation that lasted, well, of course, most of them were standing anyway, but giving an ovation that lasted for 5 minutes at the end of the game, even though Arsenal had lost 5-4. That's the kind of entertainment value that they gave and how lovable they were. When they gathered, it wasn't by limo or I don't know, some private transport, because they all walked to Old Trafford to take the plane in February 1958. Duncan Edwards cycled from his digs in Chalton-cum-Hardy or Stretford. Eddie Coleman, fellow midfield player, Snake Hips Coleman, known because of his sort of low centre of gravity and ability to throw players off just by swivelling his hips. He walked across the cobbled streets from the Salford district of Ordsall, 5-10 minutes from the ground at the most, across the swing bridge to Old Trafford, and they gathered at Old Trafford. And it can't be stressed enough that although they were, I'm not sure if they were yet a better team than Real Madrid, but they were catching them up. I don't think this Real Madrid team that began European Cup with 5 wins in a row, I don't think it would have been 5 in a row but for the Munich tragedy afflicting Manchester United. Maybe 4. They'd already won 3 in 1958. But whether they would have got to 5 with this young and burgeoning Manchester United team, I very much doubt. However, it was not only a great team. I was going to say a great team in the making, but it was already a great team. It had won 2 titles by ridiculous margins. You know, margins that you might see now, but in those days, I think it was 8 and 11 old points, which would be 12 and 18 points today. Those were the margins by which they won the league. And they were going for a third successive title, but in my opinion, they'd have struggled to do it. We were about to find out, because the next visitors to Old Trafford were Wolves, who were their main challengers and who ended up winning the league. But they were more than that. They were a great bunch of mates. They really were. And, I mean, typical was that on the day that of their final league match, the players wanted to get back on that train because they wanted to socialise, go out for a few beers with the reserves who'd beaten Wolves back in Manchester. So they were just all a bunch of they were very much what Matt Busby had wanted his teams to be, families. You know, they were like basically a bunch, slightly mischievous, some of them. They varied all in character. Bent was a very quiet family man. So was Billy Whelan. He wasn't a family man, he was engaged to be married, but before he got engaged, people assumed that he was training for the priesthood. He was so devout and you know, well behaved in his behaviour. And yet there were some real scamps. You know, Coleman was dressed as a you know, in all the latest styles. And there were a few of them that liked a pint. Tommy Taylor liked a pint. David Pegg. You know, they enjoyed going out for a few beers, and so they were a mixed bunch, but they were a lovely bunch, you know. And they all gathered on that fateful day. I think it would be the 4th of February 1958.
I mean, even the last game, the game that they played in Belgrade, which finished 3-3.
Yep.
Great game of football.
That meant, if you take into account the Arsenal game, which they won 5-4, they went into a 3-0 lead, threw it away, and they did exactly the same thing in Belgrade and came back to get a 3-3 draw. So their last two matches the Busby Babes played, they threw away 3-goal leads. And that just sort of summed them up somehow, didn't it?
There was no tactical approach to it, no overriding tactical approach. They would just want to play football and play attacking football and express themselves. And that is probably best summed up in the nature of the game, really. Yeah. And, you know, it's such a incomprehensible tragedy what came after that, made all the more profound by the fact that these were local lads.
I have a scouting system whose sole object is to go out looking for young promising school boys, youth club boys, and indeed any young players who have the necessary natural ability to make a future Man United player.
This is Love Sport.
The players were so good and so talented and were, in my opinion, certain to win the European Cup. We were certain to do it. But then when we were called in at Munich on the way back to refuel, there was some bad weather and of course we all know what happened then.
Well, United had qualified for the semi-finals of the European Cup yet again, as they always seem to, the Busby Babes. And so there were always banquets after European matches in those days. You didn't come back straight away like they do now. And there was a banquet in Belgrade. And so as the plane took off for Munich, where it was to refuel, there were a few sore heads, because the players had asked for half an hour out on the town. Sorry, they'd asked to be able to go out on the town. Busby had told the captain, Roger Byrne, half an hour. Anyway, they agreed, they protested, and it was agreed they could have a little longer. A few of them really stretched that, by the way, went to a nightclub. So there were a few sore heads, a few ready for sleep as they got on the plane the following morning. On the flight to Munich, where for the refueling, the conditions worsened. They were already bad. But the pilots, Captains Thane and Raymond, could just about see the runway at Munich from the tracks left by other aircraft. And they did manage to land the plane in the snow without any incident. And it just seemed like a routine refueling. It was snowing again. In fact, two of the players, Peg and Coleman, chucked snowballs at the ground crew. You know, it's just part of the fun. And one of the players started singing "Baby, It's Cold Outside," which was a popular song at the time, and it was. The wings were examined. You know, the usual safety things were done. The refueling was completed and the plane attempted to take off. But as it gathered speed, there was sort of the waves of slush that were being thrown up by the wheels grew. And one of the captain, Raymond, who was actually driving the plane, detected an uneven note in the engines and said, "Abandon takeoff." He knew what to do. But basically, they just abandoned and everyone went back into the terminal building. They came out again. He thought he knew how he could make the plane take off, but it didn't happen. So the takeoff was aborted for the second time. And by now, the sort of jokes, the snowballing and the "baby, it's cold outside," had gone a bit quiet. The third takeoff was accompanied by a certain amount of tension. There was no joking. And there was a lot of seat swapping. And that seat swapping largely dictated who was to live and who was to die. Because the rear section of the plane, which for some reason, conventional wisdom thought was the safer one, because in the Second World War, a lot of rear gunners had been the only ones to survive. That turned out to be a particularly lethal area, and the players who died and the journalists who all but one died were all in the rear section, which actually in the end caught fire. So it was really tragic that this sort of seat swapping that took on, for example, the steward, a man, 42-year-old man called Tommy Cable, who had only gone on the plane because he was a United fan, and he always rearranged these rotas with British European Airways so that he could get on the flights to away matches, and the lads would fix him up with a ticket and all that. At the very last minute, he offered to swap a seat with a passenger, a Yugoslav man called Bato Tomasevic, who looked nervous. Well, they all looked nervous. And Bato Tomasevic survived, and Tommy Cable died. In a way, I was glad when I wrote the book about the section about Munich in my book about Matt Busby, I was so glad to be able to make the point about Tommy Cable, because some of the suggestions in other accounts of the tragedy I think were a little unfair to him. And so it was good to be able to put the record straight. Anyway, there were so many aspects to that tragedy, and some players lived, you know, while others died because of the seat arrangements.
Was it hard delving into that when you were writing the book?
By far the hardest part of the book to write, but it was the one I had to get right. I was dreading it. I honestly was dreading, I enjoyed every other part of doing it, but that bit I was dreading. Where I was incredibly lucky was that the hero, or one of the heroes and the principal hero, in my opinion, of the whole of the survival of Matt Busby and others who survived, was Harry Gregg, the goalkeeper. And Harry, thank God, had survived and was still surviving as I was researching the book. And he very kindly allowed me into his house in Northern Ireland to spend a day with him and talk through exactly who was where and what happened on the plane. But on the third takeoff, it's very difficult to find anything funny about that, but Harry told me that when the third takeoff took place, and players genuinely thought, because air travel was much more dangerous in those days than it is now, there had been a fatal air crash at Ringway, as Manchester Airport was called in those days, less than a year earlier, and Harry, like everybody else, was worried. And he, one thing that went through his head was that he'd been reading a novel. He did, you know, like some of the players took books to read on the and he'd been reading a novel that he said was, it would be considered pretty tame these days, but he'd been brought up as a good Christian boy in Ireland, and the novel had contained some sort of fairly juicy passages, and he thought, oh no, if I get killed, will I still go to heaven? And just the thought of this, I don't know, it made me laugh, and sort of, I don't know, it sort of seemed to help while going through this overwhelmingly tragic subject. Anyway, the plane, you know, it's often described as an air crash, but of course the plane never got into the air. The pilots, heroically, when they realised it wasn't going to get off on the third takeoff, it was going straight for a house, and the pilots managed, the last thing they did was to steer it away from the house, which contained a woman and three children, all of whom survived, but not, you know, the majority of people who were on the plane.
You do what comes naturally to you on a certain day. So all this nonsense about what I'm supposed to have done, I can do without it. I was the best goalkeeper in the world at one time, not John Wayne. I am no different than anybody else. I am a survivor. End of story.
This is Love Sport.
3 days before, the press had carried pictures of a confident team leaving for Belgrade. Pictures which remind us that with them were eight of the North's finest sporting journalists who would never see home again.
So there were 23 people in total, Paddy, that died
as a result
of the crash.
Yeah.
Eight of those were the Busby Babes. Duncan Edwards would unfortunately pass away later in hospital. But in terms of those upon impact, there was Eddie Coleman, there was Liam Whelan, David Pegg, Mark Jones, Jeff Bent, Tommy Taylor, and the captain at the time, Roger Byrne.
Yeah, absolutely. And so not only had the heart of the team been torn out, but some of the players who normally would have come in to replace them, Jeff Bent being a perfect example. Also David Pegg, who was an international winger. He was one of five internationals, England and Ireland internationals, who couldn't get into the team that played Arsenal in the last game. So it's difficult to overstate the effect of the footballing effect, quite apart from the human tragedy, the footballing effect of the disaster. And the other thing was that although Matt Busby survived and was to survive, as everybody knows, in the long term, he also lost two of his assistants, Tom Curry and Bert Wally, who he really, really trusted, good men, and the secretary of the club, Walter Crickmer. There was hardly anything left of the structure of the club, but luckily for Manchester United, what was left was Jimmy Murphy. Because Jimmy Murphy had not gone to Munich because he was also manager of Wales. Funnily enough, he might have, in the World Cup, that everybody was looking forward to in 1958, as manager of Wales, he might have met Matt Busby, who'd agreed to be manager of Scotland in that World Cup. Jimmy Murphy had been looking after Wales in the second leg of their World Cup playoff against Israel in Cardiff. He'd wanted to go with the team to Munich, to Belgrade, but Busby had said, no, if anything went wrong with Wales, you'd never forgive yourself. It'll be all right. Tom Curry and Bert Wally will come with me instead. So Jimmy Murphy came back from Wales, very happy because Wales had won, very happy because United had won, and knowing nothing about the aftermath.
Somehow he got to Old Trafford still not knowing that it had happened. He got the train to Manchester from Wales.
From Cardiff, yeah.
And then got a taxi from Manchester Piccadilly. Well, it would be a different name then, Station Road. He got the train from Piccadilly to Old Trafford. Sorry, he got the taxi from...
Yeah, good.
From taxi, the train station to Old Trafford, and still didn't have any idea about the nature of the disaster, or even anything about the disaster. Would have missed the evening billboards, you know, outside, you know, with the newspapers, missed everything like that. Got to Old Trafford and the secretary, Alma George, was there.
Alma George, yeah.
And told him that the boys had all died, and he found it difficult to comprehend. I think the story goes that he went into his office with a bottle of whiskey.
That's right.
And then came out in the early hours of the morning with an empty bottle and no real idea of how he was going to go forward, only that he needed to go to Munich.
And yet he had, while emptying that bottle of whiskey, he'd managed to remember enough to try and get in touch with as many of the players' families as he could. A remarkable man. You've written a book about Jimmy Murphy, and truly remarkable man.
Yeah, he was. In my mind, he's the most important man in United's history for the reasons we're about to go into. But also, I do want to say, while we're giving credit to those people who deserve it, who don't get credit, Joe Armstrong also undertook a lot of those administrative duties, where he had to contact the families as well. You can't even begin to comprehend how something like that affects them, because like you were saying earlier, it was a family that Matt Busby had built. It wasn't just a football club, it was a family. So they they're all dealing with this grief. And I think it was really that human aspect. That was the only thing that was on the minds of anyone when Murphy went to Munich. He wasn't thinking about rebuilding Manchester United. He was looking after his friends. He wanted to see that they were all right. When he got to Munich, and he got to the hospital where all the club, all the players and the staff were, he saw Matt in an oxygen tent. I think he'd already been read the last rites at one point, and he survived. Yeah. And he went to see him. He looked gravely ill.
Sorry to interrupt, but Matt's wife Jean and the children Sandy and Sheena arrived, and Sandy couldn't restrain himself. He had to rush into the hospital, and he went past a room in which there was an old man covered in bandages and with his leg sort of in traction, and he went past him thinking, I've got to find my dad. And that was his dad. I mean, Matt was in such a mess and had almost aged because of the trauma of the crash. So it was a terrible time.
When Jimmy went to Matt's bedside, all Matt said to him was, keep the flag flying, Jimmy.
Yep.
And it's such a profound statement, and Paddy and I have talked about this in the past, like there are a few profound statements made between them, such as Matt saying to Jimmy, if you don't go with Wales, you'll never forgive yourself.
Yeah.
And then this statement, which signalled immediately the rebirth of the football club, because Jimmy, who was bereft and lost, he was obviously grieving at the same time, he didn't have a purpose moving forward, but suddenly Matt, who Jimmy idolised, gave him a purpose, and that was to go back to Manchester.
Keep that flag flying.
Literally to do that. An absolutely remarkable decision from Jimmy to do that, to use that as inspiration. And it's important to say here that Jimmy did use that. He wasn't shameful in using the fact that they were going to use grief to motivate in the following few months after that. Such a powerful tool that they used for the players to be inspired to play above themselves, the scratch squad of players who came in. So with Joe Armstrong back in Manchester, they considered the best course of action while, you know, obviously Duncan was still alive at that point. And I think there was a little period of time where Jimmy was thinking, once Duncan comes back, we'll build the team around
him. On that day you talked about before, when Jimmy and the Busbys and all the others had gone on the flight to Munich to check on the casualties. And Duncan, of course, was still alive at this time. And so Jimmy called in on him, and Duncan said, what time's the kickoff on Saturday? I mean, because there was this game against his hometown club, Wolves, you know, which was going to settle the title. And so Jimmy said, 3:00. So Duncan sort of gave him the thumbs up and said, get stuck in. But it's extraordinary that 10 days later Duncan would be dead.
Yeah, but in that period of time, even Duncan doing that and Busby doing the same, those words, what they said were enough to inspire Murphy to go back. With Joe Armstrong, they considered the best course of action. Obviously, they needed to bring players in, and there was an outpouring of support, that particularly from Hungarian players who offered to play for free, but their wages were astronomical, and there was a lot of red tape in terms of getting them to play in the British game.
One was Ferenc Puskas.
And Busby and Murphy absolutely idolised him as a player.
Yeah.
So that would have been perfect if they could have done that, but everything was just prohibitive with that. Liverpool and Forest offered players, but they were reserve players. And
Bishop Auckland and the noted amateur club, Lent 3.
Yeah.
Yep.
And that was
one of whom became an England player while with United. Yeah.
And that was enough to shore up the reserve side,
which
United badly needed. Like Paddy was saying earlier, it wasn't just the first team, it was the reserve side that was decimated as well.
And they bought two. There was Ernie Taylor, who was a really highly rated Blackpool midfield player, crafty, the guy who supplied the ammunition for Stanley Matthews in the Blackpool, highly successful Blackpool side. They managed to get him for £8,000 because he was 32. And they also signed from Aston Villa, who'd beaten them in the cup final the year before, Stan Crowther, who was a sort of box-to-box midfield player. But apart from that, and reserves, that was Jimmy Murphy had to cobble that team together.
And that, I think that was more by choice as well, because he could have had the option of going out and signing more players, but he made that decision. Well, these two lads are experienced. They've come in to steady the ship. You've got the three from Bishop Auckland over there to help with the reserve side. But he decided to make do with what he had and move forward with that. And that was a massive thing for United, because he could have easily brought in eight or nine players and just changed the entire composition of the first team. But his idea was to just do it the same way they've always done it, as much as he possibly could. And that was as much as he possibly could do at the time. He knew with those younger players coming in that it would be an emotionally charged time for them all. As soon as Greg and Charlton would come back, and Folks from their injuries sustained in the crash, that he would try and use all these kind of emotional barriers really as inspiration to fight on. And they did, and they got to the FA Cup final that season remarkably. And it's impossible to, we're talking about overstating the scale of the tragedy, it's impossible to overstate the influence and impact that period of time had on Manchester United's identity as a football club. It made, what Jimmy did, it was instilling this desire to play for something more than just a shirt. You were playing for people who died. And while that might seem, in today's day and age, it might seem a bit close to the knuckle in a certain way, because it's so raw, and you think, oh, that might even be in bad taste.
Yeah.
But all they had were grief. They had grief and raw emotion, and they used that to inspire them to win football matches, and they did win football matches.
Yeah, the first match was only less than 2 weeks later. It was against Sheffield Wednesday at Old Trafford, and Shea Brennan, who was later to take part in 10 years later to take part in a historic match at Wembley, made his debut at 20. He took a corner and the wind blew it into the net, and United won 3-0. And there was Michael Parkinson was a reporter at the match, and he said Wednesday might have as well have played in ballet shoes, so careful were they not to bruise their opponents or in any way offend the anguish of the multitude. And you can understand, you know, you talked about the question of taste, and it must have been difficult for the Wednesday players at that time. But for the United ones, it reminds me a little bit of Liverpool after Hillsborough, who, you know, also played 2 weeks later, and they played with ferocity. And the word often used there was catharsis. Well, there was definitely a cathartic quality about that Manchester United run to the FA Cup final. And when they got there, of course, Matt Busby was able to come and take his usual place on the bench.
Bobby Charlton injured in the crash, and Mr. Murphy, understudy to Matt Busby, now saw the ball curl into Wednesday's goal from a corner by Brennan.
17-year-old Mark Pearson has the ball. Alec Dawson's ready to receive. And there's number three. Old Trafford's seen some many great days, but for brilliant triumph over disaster, surely none will ever be as great as this.
If Wednesday were generous opponents, and I've got no doubt that they were, Jimmy Murphy had his team talks made for him in the coming weeks, because I'm sure Paddy found in research for his book, as I did for mine, that not everybody was quite so generous towards Manchester United. You had Bob Lord, the chairman of Burnley, who was very critical. He didn't understand. He thought the sympathy had gone too far, which, you know,
it was typical of Bob Lord, unfortunately.
Yeah, and Jimmy Murphy took that very badly. But in him saying things like, you know, the sympathy's gone too far and everyone's got to worry about themselves and not just Manchester United, that was Jimmy's team talk. He said, we'll go out there and, you know, play the game. And that was what they used in those months after Munich. Incredible, really, that they got to the FA Cup final. And to achieve that, to show that they could compete despite these most harrowing circumstances, was a testament to attitude and commitment, really. And that's the... those are the qualities that Jimmy brought to the football club, and they were never more present than they were in those days and weeks and months after Munich.
In the most sensitive way that I can say this as well, Wayne, there were a few players at the club at the time too who weren't directly involved in Munich, but whose careers then had an adverse effect because of the tragedy that happened.
Yeah, not just two. There are two what I figure to be high-profile casualties. But people forget about, obviously, there were players who died, there were players who were emotionally affected. You know, obviously, Bobby Charlton would carry those scars with him. Harry Gregg, for a long time, famously never spoke about it. Mm-hmm. Bill Foulkes was another.
Nobody ever spoke about it at the club.
But the players who came in after Munich, it must have been, they're just almost like forgotten victims in a way, because they weren't people who died, but their careers were forever changed by what, by first of all the level of expectation and the weight of grief as well, because these were, remember, their friends had died, they still had to go on playing. The two players that I mention more than others are Alex Dawson, and the reason why he comes to mind is he'd made his debut, as Paddy said earlier, he made his debut maybe about a year earlier than that. He was being integrated into the first team, and when he came in to side after Munich, he did brilliantly, scored an FA Cup semi-final hat-trick. He was pulling up trees, he was playing brilliantly. But because he was exposed to a level of football and a physicality of football that he wasn't physically perhaps ready for, his career burned out much earlier than it should have done. And the other player is Mark Pearson, and the argument is slightly different with him, because what he'd been through, it changed his attitude as a player. Yeah. He was possibly a classy player before, just a determined midfield player, but after Munich, and it's funny that we mentioned Burnley, because Burnley is probably the prime example of that. Pearson was involved in a few scraps with the Burnley players, and it provoked another outburst from Bob Lord calling United's players Teddy Boys.
Yeah.
Which was deemed a pretty bad insult in those days. Yeah. But the point being that Mark Pearson's attitude changed. He became a bit of a nastier player in midfield. It changed his development as a player. So these players who became secondary casualties in Munich, yeah, the skip development stages that the reserve team would have given them, or a more gradual integration into the first team.
Yeah.
And like I said, I've mentioned two, but there were countless other players like that, and you wouldn't know, like an Alan Wardle or Jim Elms, players, you wouldn't know their potential because they skipped that development stage.
Yes, that's right.
You wouldn't have known how they would have been integrated into the first team, because that entire system had been ruined.
Yeah, I think also when it would be remiss not to add that although eight players died as a result of Munich, 10 careers died, because Jackie Blanchflower and Johnny Berry, who were, you know, up there with anybody else in the team, apart from perhaps Edwards, they never played again. So that you know, has to be added to the footballing effects of the tragedy.
Didn't Johnny Berry have to have his entire teeth removed?
Yeah. There were horrific injuries. You know, the number of bones that Blanchflower broke was... at least they lived, but their careers died. United didn't win the cup that year, by the way. They were beaten again, and again involving an injury to a goalkeeper, because Harry Gregg was tough as old boots, but he didn't like being hit in the back, certainly not in the way that Nat Lofthouse of Bolton hit him. And United lost, and but at least, you know, they'd got to the cup final. Matt Busby was there alongside Murphy, who quite rightly was regarded as the actual manager, the cup final manager. And really all that left after that was the remainder of the European campaign, which had taken them to Munich in the first place. And that was not surprisingly pursued by train and ferry rather than air. Although United had won the home leg 2-1, they were beaten 4-0 in San Siro, and that was it.
This is Love Sport.
It's Barclay and Barton on a post-war history of Manchester United here on Love Sport. This episode in particular focusing on the Munich air disaster. And Wayne, to finish, you've spoken about the inspiration that this ended up becoming for Manchester United and the fact that it ultimately shaped the future of the club, and you were fortunate enough to sit down with Sir Alex, and I put those questions to him.
Yeah, I mean, I was, for the biography that I wrote on Jimmy. And I was mentioning about inspiring a new standard after Munich, like I just said earlier, you know, about the way that Jimmy's sort of grief counselling, for want of a better word, inspired United to play in a way that they hadn't done before, and it added this extra layer to the sort of personality of the club. And as I was mentioning about inspiring a new standard, I put it to Sir Alex that because of what Jimmy did after Munich, perhaps it had some influence on the mentality and personality of the club and team under his stewardship. And, you know, he not only agreed, which I can tell you as any United fan, to present a theory on the club to its greatest ever manager and have him agree is the biggest thrill ever.
Yeah.
He discussed openly that he actually used it as motivation. He said, and I quote, "Telling a young player at Manchester United what Jimmy did is the most important thing you can do for them." So to him, it is no coincidence. It was a tool, in fact. Yes. And from a manager who used every tool in the book and then created a new book with new tools, this being one of them, to instill that work ethic into the players who didn't know when they were beaten, and they knew that they had to give everything to the club because of what the players had given for the shirt beforehand. You know, for me, it was no coincidence that the attitude was so prominent in the club's greatest moments. And, you know, they did, those greatest moments did come 10 years after Jimmy died. But the way that he used tragedy to inspire is something that is unique to the fabric of United. Obviously, they don't do that in the same way these days. But using what Jimmy did is something that Sir Alex was very happy to do.
I think also that it's very important that through Wayne, certainly through Wayne, that the legacy, the life of Jimmy Murphy is being revisited, and propagated among a new generation or several new generations of Manchester United support. What's so important about it is that when you examine Murphy's life, selflessness is a theme. Is that fair?
Absolutely.
He was totally slavishly welded to the cause of Manchester United. He really was. And I think that that's part of what Ferguson meant. The devotion that he showed to the cause was part of what Manchester United should be.
The story that's often said by his sons about Jimmy is that if he had a bed, if there was a bed for him at Old Trafford, he would have slept there as well. That he put the club above his family. And I think that's probably fair. His devotion to the club, his devotion to Matt Busby, it was unwavering.
I think he'd still have found time for the odd hour in the Throstle's Nest pub in Whalley Range.
Yeah,
that was another love of his life.
Yeah, but it's also, we should mention the fact that he was coach of Wales and he took them to the World Cup, which until recently was the greatest ever achievement. He was courted by great clubs around the world. Arsenal wanted him, Juventus wanted him, Brazil wanted him as a coach, and he turned down all. He probably seriously considered the Arsenal one.
Yeah, I think that was the one that that made him think more than any other.
But there was one approach, and
but he would never have gone.
There was one approach that came in, maybe it might have been March or April after Munich, and it was from another northwestern club. It was never revealed who, but I had a suspicion it was Liverpool from the term, from the way that things were.
I think
referred.
Also that you know, people talk about certain managerial partnerships, you know, Shankly and Paisley, Clough and Taylor, Busby and Murphy deserves to be spoken about like that. You know, in a way that this is something that has to be weighed when you do the argument, Busby or Ferguson. Ferguson didn't have Jimmy Murphy, because what happened was that in Ferguson's time, his assistant, they kept doing so well that people would say, "Hey, we'll take Steve McLaren, we'll take Carlos Queiroz." Well, you know, he kept losing his assistants. Archie Knox, he kept losing assistants like that. But Jimmy Murphy just stayed and stayed and stayed. And that, in a way, was an advantage that Matt had that Sir Alex didn't.
If you can take a positive from such a tragedy, Paddy.
Yes.
Those involved in it, the faint glimmer of light, I suppose, they can hold is that, as Wayne has brilliantly explained, is that it did ultimately shape the future of Manchester United.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. Manchester United is it's a horrible thought because you wish it had never happened, but Manchester United is part of what makes the club special is that so much of its spirit was burnished in tragedy. And as you say, you wish it were otherwise. But when you go there, you see the Munich clock, and I'm talking about a neutral. You know, Manchester United fans will say, "Yeah, blah blah blah." We know this when we see the. We know what we feel like when we see the Munich clock. But what I'm talking about is what the likes of me think. You know, when we go and see the Munich clock, when we see the statue of Samat, when we see the sort of manifestations of history that are around Old Trafford, it's what it means to the wider world that makes Manchester United special.
I don't think the world will ever again, no, the world will never again see a group of players like the Busby Beard. They were the best, without doubt.
The finest English keeper that ever graced a net. Oh, England's finest football team, its records truly great. Its proud success as mocked by a cruel turn of fate. Eight men will never play again who met destruction there.
The flowers of English football.
The flowers of English football.
The flowers of English football.
The flowers of English football, the flowers of Manchester.
This is Love Sport.